Diversity, equity and inclusion, community engagement, public policy-informed corporate social responsibility, and equity-focused philanthropy are the major strategic service areas that Justice Informed uses to ignite people, processes, and cultures. They help the companies and organizations they work with to execute these guiding principles in ways that take advantage of a globalized world, workforce, and production system. Their teams work with organizations to develop public policy-informed, sociologically supported strategies for a more dynamic and inclusive workforce. Translation: cutting-edge, human-centered, strategic, and relevant. What better way to launch our 2019 Mrs. Green's World Show than by learning about an organization completely aligned with our values? Hi, everybody. I'm Gina Murphy-Darling, and Happy New Year. This is Mrs. Green's World, and how did we get here so fast? This is the first show of 2019. So let's hope that we are going to see record numbers of people waking up and getting engaged in significant ways to help preserve this great planet of ours and to end some of the many injustices that still exist. I can assure you that our team will be doing our part to continue our work and being disruptors for good. Thank you so much for being a part of it year after year, or if it's just a beginning, thank you for joining the journey with us. I honestly could not think of a better guest to launch our new year than the guest we're going to have, Xavier Ramey. He and his organization, Justice Informed, are aligned with our values, so much so that it's hard to even articulate. But they are doing the hard work, the important work with organizations and companies that is required to change mindsets, to build strategies productively and empathetically, and are helping to get those organizations to engage the communities around them. So please join me in welcoming our guest for this next hour, the CEO of Justice Informed, Xavier. And Xavier, did I say your name right? Is it Ramey?
Ramey.
Okay, Ramey, and I probably don't have to say it again, so that's good. I really should have asked you before we got on air, but people who listen to me a long time are used to this. I never mean to have that be a slight, but I get so excited, especially about this show. It's so serendipitous that you are our premier show, and it was very intentional on our part. So it's great to have you here, and I would just like to give our listeners a better sense of who you are and what you have accomplished so far, because I think it's really, really important. So Xavier is the CEO of Justice Informed, which is a social impact consulting firm based in Chicago. He is an award-winning social strategist, noted public speaker, and conflict mediator. Combining his background in economics, extensive management and social impact experience, and direct action campaigning in the Black Lives Matter movement, Xavier leads a company that brings a wealth of experience and network to clients seeking catalyzed strategies for inclusion, philanthropy, corporate social responsibility, and community engagement. It's me. We say this in the Southwest. It's the whole green enchilada. It's a very systemic approach. So Xavier, sir, isn't that good? Like, I love that. It's just, yeah, it's the whole package, because you've thought of everything that needs to be included. You also served as the lead of the social innovation and philanthropy strategy in the University of Chicago's Office of Civic Engagement, managed multi-million-dollar philanthropic portfolios to stimulate employment, and worked as a nonprofit director of development in Chicago's North Lawndale community. You are a founding member of the Let's Breathe Collective, an artist activist organization committed to addressing state violence against people of color. So that's a lot, but it all matters. And thank you for being here.
Thank you so much, Tina. I do appreciate it.
So I'd like to kind of divide the show into two parts. I gave that great introduction about Justice Informed, but it really makes sense to start out with you, because so much of what you're doing was shaped by what happened to you, your background, and how you're showing up in the world today. So we're going to talk about you for a bit, because
okay.
It's the crux of it. I listened to that Rotary speech, which is how we heard about you. My friend Ray Naylor from my Rotary Club, who's an outstanding Rotarian, came back from the conference in Chicago last year and said, you have to interview this man on your show. And here we are. It took a while, but here you are. So
here we are.
Yes. One of the things that you talk about is the difference between what is possible but not probable. And I read that and then I rewinded it and rewinded it. And you said getting where you are today was always possible but not probable. What do you mean by that, and what helped make it probable? Because you didn't answer that in the video.
Yeah, I'll answer the second part of that first. I don't always like to tell people what the solutions are because I have a firm belief that people disengage from the hard work of persevering through systemic injustice to move it towards a more just reality because they get too focused on the outcome rather than the importance of going through the work. I liken it to, you know, when you say, for instance, when you have a child, you tell the parent, oh, it's going to be so awesome, you're going to have a doctor one day. Or do you say, it's going to be so awesome to walk these years with your child? Right, the process is really what we need people to commit more and more to. And so I sometimes withhold the whole, like, how I did it and how it happened because I want people to know that that my journey wasn't a usual one, and I don't want them to standardize that or to think that it could work for someone else and just parade that to some other young African-American young man and say, if you could just do what Xavier did, you know, when the reality is that, you know, the things that came together to turn into my life story were not ones that were very probable in any way. And it often hurts people who are still in those situations of injustice to sort of dangle someone who made it, quote unquote, in front of them without understanding that you have to make a lifelong commitment for that person to bring them out of it.
So deep in my soul, I knew that this was going to be a very important and intentional show, and that is one of the best answers, because the answer is there isn't a formula. You don't do X right. plus Y with human beings and get Z. To me, a lot of it, I mean, I have goosebumps, and I'm not kidding. It's about showing up and
exactly.
and being the change, and the dynamics will never be the same. So thank you for that really well-thought-out answer, and you are spot on. It's like, I love it. Okay, so there. Hyperbole. I'm the queen of it.
Yeah.
But, you know, and then you said there's another quote, but there have to be some like basic mindsets or approaches or philosophies, because another
Absolutely.
Quote that I got from you, it's powerful. Our work at Justice Informed and in Rotary is not to bring things more possible in the world. It is to make things probable in the world and to do the most for those who are kept out of the roads, and I think it was the word words, and rooms of equality.
Of equity.
Of equity, yes. The rooms, and I think you said who are kept out of the roads and rooms of equity. So talk about...
I don't like the word equality. I try not to use it very often.
No, equity. It was really like, yeah. What does that even mean too? It's like equity. It does mean something. So expand on that a little bit, what our roles
sure.
are.
Yeah, and I think everyone has a role. That's the awesome thing about it. One of the things that I often tell my team is that the diversity of the chaos requires a diversity of the response, and that's why we're all required for this work. The ways that people distract and deflect from themselves to really commit to each other, which is really what justice is about. It's about establishing a relational and systemic commitment to one another and saying that fundamentally the point of life is not simply to sustain my own breathing at a very simple level. But the point of life is to ensure that my breaths count for those others who have to live with me, as well as myself. And when it comes to the roles that people have, I really think it depends on that person. You know, I try not to be prescriptive in saying, hey, what you need to do is this, what you need to do is that to make a difference or give back or otherwise. What I prefer to do is to ask questions that allow people to understand and confront their fears. Because the work of justice really starts with confronting your fears of what equity would mean for them, for you, what taking on a more proactive stance about being what some people would call socially radical, which to me is, I don't know why people are so confused. You know, they get so uptight about the word radical. The etymology of it means literally to the root. You would think that people would want to get to the root of things.
You would think.
Yeah, but being a radical often means that you're saying things that are awkward, but also necessary. You know, you're addressing the elephants in the room, which means that once you've addressed them, you have more room in that room to do what you need to do. The rotary thing that I talked about with probability and possibility, it really speaks to the challenge of vocabulary within the specifically the Western world, and then hyper-specifically within America, where we talked about everything is possible, right? We hear this mantra, right? In America, things are possible, and that's the big promise that people sell about America. The American dream being a possibility is something that we hear politicians often talk about promising from, you know, from the voter booth. But the reality is that possibility is I think, a form of violence when you have resources that are withheld from people.
Go ahead. I'm sorry. Didn't mean to interrupt. Go ahead.
No, I think the most important litmus for a society has nothing to do with whether something is possible. I think it has to do with whether it's probable. And that points down to, is this something that the society is making, are they smoothing out the inroads and the on-ramps for people to access this thing that they said is possible? So if you say that a quality education is not only important, but given that we have a functioning public school system in the United States, it's also possible. But the reality is that the quality of it doesn't necessarily equip students for what they would assume the outcome would be, given that they have access to public education, as we can see from the way in which our public education system churns out students who are unprepared for the 21st century. And so fighting for probability is far more important to me than just possibility. If you put a bowl of water in front of me, you can say it's possible that I won't die of thirst. But if you cut off my hands and tie me down, it's very improbable that I won't. So to put that piece of water in front of me and tell the world that, you know, that bit of water in front of me and tell the world that, hey, anything's possible around me, and I'm just because it's possible, without factoring in the limitations that are imposed upon me, that's why I said possibility can be a form of violence.
So true. Like, bam, that's all I want to say. There's nothing more to elaborate on that. It's like, bam, yes, you're absolutely right. But you also said in that speech, we are alive now. We are alive now. 2018 was one of the roughest years of my life, one of the most challenging, one of the most painful. I mean, every value that I hold dear, I believe, was under attack. And as much as we tried to keep the show not political, we're talking about my values, which are not political. They're values. They don't have that label. So are we alive? Are we alive now? Or are so many people asleep at the wheel? They don't care about global warming. They're still doing Black Friday, for God's sake. I'm like, really? Are we having Black Friday again this year? All of it makes me sick. So this is a show to kind of set the tone. And what better person than you? Are we alive? We are alive now? Tell us. Give us what you mean by that.
I definitely think we're alive now. I said that in my Rotary speech was in June 2018, and I still believe it today. I believe that we're alive for a couple of reasons. One, because we are physically so, and that's the obvious stuff. But the reality is that we still have a chance, and that's really what living is about. Hope fundamentally is based upon the idea that tomorrow is possible. No one has hope who doesn't think that tomorrow is possible. And so when I say we are alive, it means that I'm hoping. It doesn't mean that I'm hoping. One of the strategies that we use with our clients, and I often tell our team and some of our community consultants that, hey, you know, the biggest get that we can have is not to convince someone. It's to get them to consider. Because what we're actually asking people to do when we talk about companies that are taking on issues of injustice, or we're talking about nonprofit boards that are predominantly white, and primarily because boards fundraise and white people have most of the returns to income and have so for the entirety of the American history. You know, when they're engaging that challenge and they want to diversify, what we're really trying to say is, you know, we're trying to substitute a framework for your life that you have operated within your entire life as you know it. And so we have to gently engage that. One of the things I talk about is holding people as they thrash You know, there's a term in society, it's like getting woke. They say like, oh, I'm woke. That means like you're socially conscious.
Right.
But the reality is that when people wake up spiritually or psychologically or intellectually, it's the same as when they wake up physically. They're often groggy. And they're trying to figure out what day it is.
Right.
They got to do. Right? They're rushing. They don't want to rush. But there's the urgency of all the time they have in front of them. And it's also the most hopeful time. And that's what people don't think about. They don't think about the fact that 7 a.m. when the alarm rings is the most hopeful time for you. You don't know what's coming, which means everything can come. At 7 p.m., the day looks very different. And so are we alive? Absolutely. And the moment that people come to the point where they're willing to consider equity, they're willing to consider a more benevolent way of living, where they're willing to consider a more inclusive and intersectional way of looking at the world, that's the morning to me. And that's a huge win. That's a hard win to get to because most people fight like hell to stay asleep.
Yes.
It's a hard thing.
It's easier.
But
to be asleep.
We fight for that.
Yes.
Well, I think it's easier because people, you know, look, the field of social impact consulting and the conversations around D&I, I think they've done so many disservices. People are going out there and they're training to maintain fragility. They're training for incremental steps. And I think that does a disservice to the urgency of our work. I understand and I concede that the human spirit is a hard thing to bend. I understand and I concede that the work of, like, for instance, talking to white persons in America about white fragility is a hard thing to do. Of getting people to understand the pervasiveness of white supremacy and not get them to immediately think of like a Klan member with a hood on or something, but to understand that, you know, the divestment of black communities through things like the mortgage schemes prior to the Federal Housing Act was actually white supremacy. That things like voter disenfranchisement that we see in elections today is actually the permeation of white supremacy. Like, it's a hard thing to talk about that. I get that. I totally get that. But when we as practitioners, and now I'm talking about myself, my field, my industry, when we as practitioners do not understand that we are the gatekeepers to the pace of a new world, we do a disservice to the urgency of this work. And I think that cutting people slack and not using the right terms, like people throw around the term, like they say diversity and inclusion and all this, when really what they're talking about for the most part, they're saying not white.
Right.
And it's a hard, you just can't say it, right?
Yes.
You go into these companies, you just can't say white, you know?
Yeah.
Like people just, that's one of the things that we teach our, you know, up front. We say, hey, listen, this is a whisper-free zone. We're not going to whisper identity labels. So if you have to say black, you're not going to say, I was talking to my black friend, and he was really, really, we're not doing that here, okay?
Oh, my God,
we
yes.
are having a brave and accountable conversation about this. We are going to rise to the level of verbal adults, and we're going to talk about it.
There's so much integrity in that, and it's, you know, it's a perfect segue to, you will be so sure that I listened to every word in that speech and synthesize it and process it, but you talked about the ingredients for peace. And my first comment is, we don't even talk about peace as a beacon, as some place that we all want to get to enough. But you talked about the foundation and some of the things that are needed: love, intentionality, space making, historical foundation, and hope. So to me, three of those are obvious, but I would love you to elaborate a little more, maybe a lot more, on space making and historical foundation, because as you say in that, peace requires reconciliation. We have to acknowledge that harm has been caused, that we have to acknowledge another people's pain. And the hard part for that, for me, is that I get into the blame game and I want to acknowledge, you know, a group that I'm representing, acknowledge that pain, instead of thinking maybe somebody on the, what I perceive to be the other side, has some pain too. Does that make sense? That's where the problems start.
This is a significantly longer conversation.
Yeah. Well, we don't have to end. It's like, yeah, let's go with it. But space making and the historical foundation, huge.
Yeah. So I've got to back up a little bit here. My my entire praxis, meaning the way I go about doing the work of justice seeking and equity building, is foundationally built upon an understanding. And this is just a personal belief. I know everybody doesn't agree with this or maybe has not considered it. But I believe that all of this works in time. And time is a primary factor that is often excluded from this conversation. I say that because I, you know, as a black man in America, I've had to forensically investigate what the chains look like that I was born with. And I've had to truly understand the how and the why I can live in a world and a country and a city and a community and a house that that purports one thing, right? Purports accessibility to possibility, that purports a steady state of justice. Whether it be through the criminal justice system or otherwise. I've had to take that in, and then at face value and then, you know, juxtapose it to my lived experience, right? And then at the same time, at any point where my lived experience didn't line up exactly with what other people said I was experiencing, that's often, because that's often what happens, right? When people said, like, Black Lives Matter, other people told us black people how we were actually feeling.
Right.
They told us what police were actually doing to us when we were there, but they weren't. They were teaching us about our lives from our point of view that they hadn't considered.
That's always an interesting concept. Yeah. How's that working for you?
Right. Well, I mean, it's this is why issue switching is important as a tactic in my world, right? So people may not understand race, but they understand gender. And so the same person who doesn't understand why we can't say all lives matter, but they will understand that the concept of mansplaining, right? And which is someone self-censoring themselves to take up space to delegitimize someone else's claim for equity. And so we have to be, I have to be very fluid in how I approach people non-judgmentally, but also holding a certain line. And what I meant when I said about time, this is all based on time, is because privileged people always use time as a weapon. And whether that be financially or mentally or emotionally or otherwise, I'll give an example. Oftentimes when we're talking about issues of equity, take for example, you remember the Kavanaugh, the Supreme Court justice.
Oh yeah, that.
Yeah. Yeah, that. Right. When Kavanaugh was being brought in, one of the main arguments that was utilized was the time argument, which for me is a typical argument. That was a long time ago argument. It's the same argument that black people have to deal with when we talk about slavery reparations or equity things. And you know, it's a long time ago thing. And the challenge with that is, to the untrained eye, it's only looking at time as a weapon going backwards. But the reality is they're arguing for time moving forward. So Kavanaugh is a Supreme Court justice for life, meaning that he will maintain the control of the judicial system's power through time as long as he has it. They are owning time for decades to come, right? But disqualifying time moving backwards. And this is why I said practitioners aren't being savvy enough in understanding these things, that you can verbally dismantle an argument if you simply push that out to the fore rather than just focusing on, he's a bigot, or, you know, other things that obviously his supporters didn't care about. You know, it's that sort of a thing. These things are based on time. And everything from the effects that my grandmother lived through, right, like, with elections, right? My grandmother was 42 years old before the Voting Rights Act came into play, right?
That's hard to even believe it is. And yet, in this last election, let's talk about voter suppression and gerrymandering. So it's better, it's better, but it's not. We're not there. I mean, okay, I'm taking a deep breath. Take a deep breath. It's 2019.
And voting is about time.
Yes.
Voting is about owning time.
Gosh.
It's about saying what you feel time should hold for us in the next period before the next election. This is a fight about time. This is about understanding how we exist in time, how our children will exist in time, and how we understand. This goes back to that whole historical part that I talked about in the Ingredients for Peace. You also have to understand how the past played into that so you don't repeat it.
That's the historical foundation. And the thing that it's like, you can be so brutally fake. I mean, honest with me, like, you do not have to fake a thing. But one of the things that we talked about a lot in our family is we say this, and it is so white. We thought it is so white. We thought things were better. And I do, I'm not one of these people, you know, some of my best friends are black. Well, you guess what? Some of my best friends are. And one
that
of my
doesn't mean they tell you their whole lives.
But no, but I go deep with two of them, and like my friend Leda, we talk about it. And a lot of people, even with black friends, they don't talk about it. And I just say to her, what has happened recently? And she's got stories. And it's like, she said that life for her living in Tucson, Arizona, is better than when she and her husband lived in the South. But where it's like, what does better look like if you're white versus thinking what it's the experience is? But if you are, I want to say this, a black woman in inner city Chicago, maybe life doesn't feel like it's gotten so better because you're not only dealing with the shootings of black men, you're raising children. I mean, to me, that is one of the epitome of maybe their life really hasn't gotten better. And I just wanted to believe that things were better. And then all the scabs got pulled off.
Do you know, why would you even care to believe that their lives are better? Why does it matter?
Hopefully because of who I am and the world I want to live in and to be a help, to be a part of help creating where there is an opportunity for anyone with a brain and an ability to just show up in the world has the same chance as my grandchild. It's just so deep within me. It's even hard to explain. I feel like I'm, you know, stumbling over my words because I care deeply about the whole Nelson Mandela thing of, you know, I am the master of my fate. I am the captain of my soul. Well, that's true, but sometimes not really. So how can I make it better for all of us? Because I do believe, I never get that expression right, but a rising tide, you know,
lifts all boats.
It's like, yeah, if it's better for one, the world gets better. So that's part of, I don't know, maybe it's, you know, where my parents, what they put in me. I remember saying to my dad, I read the book Black Like Me. And I'm just telling you, nobody even talks about that book. It made a big impression on me. And I talked to my dad about it. And he said, well, you know, I'm Irish Catholic. And when I lived in New York, upstate New York, the Ku Klux Klan came after me. But I went to New York and I could have just changed my name. I couldn't change my color. That's what he said to me. Never forgot it. He said, when you show up, they know what color you are. So that's the difference that we have to look at changing.
Yeah. You know, I think that the this is where the space-making conversation comes in.
Okay.
That's the toughest one. You know, I was running a training last night with a management team and some board directors about how they can shift some of the practices that one of our justice-informed audits revealed, that there were a lot of challenges that they were having with their rank-and-file staff members, primarily women of color, and the organization is primarily women-led, which made for a really intersectional quandary.
Wow.
One of the challenges there is that space making is real. The need for space making is real. This goes back to language, right? One of the challenges around terms like the terms giving back or doing the right thing. I think these terms do a disservice because they're not actually root focused. So, for example, I like to use. Yeah, I try to use root focus language whenever I can. So instead of saying things like low-income people, we hear that term a lot, low-income person.
Right, right.
And it elicits a certain color and face and job occupation and educational status, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But the reality is people don't just become low-income. Low-income, you know, poverty is a creation of systems and government policies, as well as human behavior. It is not just a happenstance thing. There is choice and selection in that, and there is probability and possibility in that. And so if you're really doing a service to the people who are malaffected by something, like income inequality, which creates poverty, then you would point to the root of the thing, you know, and you would say you're talking about, for some people, they are economically excluded persons. We know that some people, this was the case for women, you know, before women were allowed into workplaces in the numbers that they are today, you know, were women economically disadvantaged, or were they actually being proactively excluded? They were being excluded.
Right.
Right. It points back to the fact that there is an other here. There's someone on the other side of this. And we can identify and work around or with or through or otherwise with that person. We can start to get to it, but we have to stop acting like this stuff is just happenstance. You know, poverty is not happenstance. The hunger issues are not happenstance. You know, there are some things in this world that are tragic, and there are some things that we are creating. And we have to be responsible for those things that we are creating, even if we marry the people who are creating them, working for the companies that promote them, or otherwise.
So when you apply that to women, yeah. Let's just take gender, because sure. I was marching for the ERA 40 freaking years ago, it feels like. I swear to God, it was like forever ago. And then it comes out, and I mean, this is not a wah-wah, that even in Hollywood, in these kick-butt shows that are so successful, it comes out that the female lead role is making less than the man. And that's really sickening, let alone people of color, okay? Let's say black people. What do you think they're making? It's just, it blows my mind. So I sometimes say, at 68 years young, what's it going to take? How do we make this work? That's an issue that we made some progress, but when the statistics come out, in comparable positions, by and large, women make less than men. So make some space for me in that conversation. It's like,
yeah,
what the heck?
The short answer is really short. We need a collective commitment to specificity. That's what I think helps with a lot of this stuff. So many things happen in the dark because we're trying to hide the reality of what's actually coming to light. And when I say specificity, I say that because, you know, I believe that justice, Dr. Cornel West says, justice is what love looks like in public. I extend that to say that love is, and it is a form of relationship that is foundationally about being specific with someone. And in that, this goes to the space making thing, sometimes we're righteously discriminating.
Yes,
a lot of people have
a hard
time with that. Right?
I agree.
Discriminating. I don't want to discriminate. It's like, well, you got married. You discriminated, right? If I go get married, that means that I'm discriminating against every other woman on earth except for one.
Right? Never thought about it that way. Oh, my gosh.
That's the truth. And I thought it was so awesome that I brought a priest to come in. Like, my whole family showed up, said the discrimination's okay. You know, we're going to create a baby and then, like, you discriminate against every other child on earth, right? And everyone's okay with this, like,
right? And we're gonna bless it, for God's sake.
We're gonna bless it. Yeah, we're gonna. You know what I mean? Like,
yes.
Like, this
yes.
is the reality. Love is about being specific. And now, why is it that form of discrimination is not only wholly accepted; it's so accepted, it's not investigated.
Yeah,
versus other types of discrimination.
You're like making me, you're saying things that I want to say. Could you hold that thought? I have to go think for a bit. So this is one of those podcasts where it's stopping me in my tracks. And I don't want to forget to ask this question, but could you explain to me, and I said to you in the very short conversation we had before we got on air, a big wake-up call for me. And I really don't think I'm righteous, and maybe I am by even saying that, but I really work hard to evolve. That's what I would say. I am constantly a work in progress, and I took this Cultivating Women's class, you know, course out in the middle of nowhere in New Mexico, and one of our assignments was to watch several shorts on white privilege. And I had a visceral reaction. I'm like, you got to be kidding me. I'm really reacting to that. You know, I'm not a racist. Well, oh, Gina, that's not what white privilege is. And when you talk about historical foundation, I had no say whatsoever. I was born with white privilege. You can't deny it. You can't have your status changed. I showed up in the world white, and therefore I had privilege. And that is a conversation that I am having with friends, saying it's not, it doesn't mean you're racist. It means you're white. Live with it. And then What can you do?
I feel like it should have been called Access. If it was just called White Access or like Pass or something,
it would have been better, because privilege is pejorative. Way, it is. That's what I reacted.
I say that, but I also, I have the lived experience of knowing that no matter how you try to define a thing, people are going to try to pull you back into the nebulous world of non-specificity.
It's so true.
Because they don't want to name the thing.
Right,
right. They don't want to. It doesn't matter what you did. We've got the sociologists in the universities trying to come up with the 15-page abstracts, right, about privilege. You've got Robin DiAngelo writing books called White Fragility. You've got people ignoring or reading things that James Baldwin wrote 50 years ago.
Right, right.
We've got all of this simply because there is a world of people who insist on not investigating themselves and have not done so, and that the mechanisms for accountability of it, they are the arbiters and judges of whether that's going to come to the fore. And that's where the only reason I even have a job is because white people don't know themselves.
put it bluntly. You'll have one for a very long time, trust me.
I know.
You got job security.
Here's the challenge. I was talking about this with one of my team members yesterday. The challenge, though, is that this is not just a skin thing. This is a mentality thing.
Absolutely, a mindset. Yes, yes.
It's so in that way, that privilege, the way that it's permeated, this is why we make the jump from the word privilege to supremacy. Right? Privilege means that you have the ability to access something. Supremacy means that everybody has to do it regardless. Right? The difference there is privilege says, hey, I have these chances in life that other people may not have, not by any virtue of my own, but by the color of my skin. And that, even if I have the same characteristics as someone else, if I do have this one skin color difference, it does have a systemic, and now we also have, an empirically defined effect in the world. Versus supremacy, which says, no matter who you are, no matter what you want in this life, no matter what you think life should be, you're going to have to conform to be safe, to produce, and to prosper. So it does not matter if you come to this melting pot called America. It does not matter if you come from Kenya. Take off your dashiki. It does not matter if you come from Eastern Europe.
Right.
Throw away your language. It doesn't matter if you come from Japan. Put away your customs. You come here, you put on a suit, you speak English, you do these things. And that comes from a primarily European and Western world tradition of focusing on what whites have tended to produce in the world. And it's not that it's a bad thing that Europe produced those things, but that the standardization of those things proliferated throughout the world in such a way that it erases so many other people from being able to prosper and access things. Like, you can't even get a business contract without a suit on.
It's the uniform.
Of America, you know what I mean? If the president of America showed up in a dashiki, they would say he's less presidential. When black boys show up and they have their pants sagging, people assume that has something to do with their intelligence. It's an article of clothing.
Right.
That has nothing to do with it. They assume that they're unprepared. No, it's simply that they're unassimilated. There's a difference. There's a difference.
The tagline from our show when we started is, we don't tell you what to think, we just want you to. And you're giving me a headache.
I have so much to
think about after this show. It's like, oh, wow, bam, there's another one. And it's good because you talk about, in this Rotary speech, which I know there are listeners out there that are part of this tribe that care deeply about all of these things, and they will listen to your speech. And another thing you said that really matters, the absence of tension is not peace. It's holding the tension. So when you said, we are alive now, we are alive now, I'm thinking there are days, literally, I'm not being a drama queen, even though I love being a drama queen. Last year, when I wished that I would get hit by a truck. And that sounds dramatic. And sometimes I would say that to my family. And I'm like, okay, I'm in the third of my life. This all sucks. Everything I believe in is being eviscerated, attacked, demonized everything, and I don't know if I can go the distance. And those obviously didn't last because I did not get hit by a truck, and here we are talking about it. But the aliveness is in the tension, but it's really exhausting at times. And that's from a middle-class white woman. It's exhausting for me because I care. I can't even imagine.
That's not why.
Oh, why is it? I mean, do you do one-on-one counseling, Xavier?
I do a lot of coaching.
I think like I'm a candidate here, dude. I really do.
Why is it? It's not the caring. And I think that this goes back to the disservice. Caring is an important thing because it produces compassion in the world. And that compassion, hopefully, when assigned with resources, can produce systemic change. But the reality of why people are having a hard time with today, I think, is the same reason why I have a hard time doing, finding the molar mass of an atom, because I haven't practiced. I don't know that math.
That's not even on my to-do list or my bucket list.
No, it's not on my... And how much is dismantling white fragility is on the to-do list of your average American, right?
It's just not.
It's not how we raise our kids. It's not what you're evaluated for on standardized tests. It's not what they ask you when you're trying to get admitted to college. It's not what's on the application when you're applying for a job. It's not what they ask you before you get married. It's not what they ask you when you're in court. They don't ask you. No one's. There's no accountability for this. And everybody's frustrated. I mean, when I was at the University of Chicago, I spent 3 years there, and one of the first revelations that I had was that these are some of the brightest students, right? This is a top 10 university on the earth.
Right.
On the earth. This is one of
the brightest.
The bastions of intelligence on the earth. The research that comes out of this place does a little bit of everything. And I'm sitting here in a room with these students, and they are so frustrated, and they're breaking down. I would always do a status check at the end of a seminar, and I would just go around and say, give me one word about how you're feeling. We've been engaging your intellect, but I know that my work fundamentally is about your heart set, not about your mindset. Your heart set's going to determine your mindset. And what I've been poking at you all is a worldview and a framework shift. And I know that hits your heart. But what's the word that explains it? And inevitably, they'd all have the same word, overwhelmed. They'd all feel overwhelmed. But I love getting, because then we could start to talk about what is it that's actually overwhelming you here. Let's dig deep and let's identify the feeling that you're feeling. And many times we come up with the word shame. They felt ashamed that they didn't know, or they felt ashamed that they felt impotent to do anything, or they felt ashamed because they felt fooled, because they thought they knew. And then they're in this platform and they have all this access and they're a top 10 student on the planet and they don't know. Not only do they not know, they can't deal with not knowing. Which says to me, it's not that they don't care. They do care. They care deeply. The reality is they're unprepared and they're sitting in front of a test called Hello, I'm Black, and they don't know what to do.
Oh my gosh. Yes. Yeah. So.
And if we had a way to prepare, I'm not saying if we had, this is what we're building in justice, right? You build mechanisms to prepare people. And it starts, you can hear my voice, right? I'm smiling as I'm speaking. Because these types of things, they simply don't bother me like they bother everyone else.
Yeah, they're bothering me in a good way. It's like cognitive.
I'm the
like
one
something.
Most affected by them, right?
Yes.
I'm the one. I've spent hours and hours in police squad cars in the city of Chicago. I've been slammed up against the walls and had the guns to my back and the get on the ground N-word by the car. I grew up in the ghetto that was created for me and my family. I emerged out of it. I had to go through those toxic workplaces and hear white men talk about my body. I've gone through all of that stuff, and the reality is that the joy I have today comes from preparation, not from a mounting and mounting and mounting fraction of care that I have no ability or resource to exercise in the world, because I simply focus on the fact that I'm upset, or I focus on the fact that, I really care. I focus on the terms like we have to give back, rather than understanding that you have to operationalize not taking first. I'm focused on the horizon of the thing, not necessarily the step. Like, I get it. There's a quagmire between us and the destination, but I really love this horizon, and I've really, really practiced with my feet, and I know how to engage people so that they can dig into tough topics and they can walk out with joy and directions. And so it's a fulfilling life's work. But I just say, you don't have to, it's not a lack of care. I know you care. I know you care. You wouldn't be talking to me if you didn't care. You know, but it there is room for preparation and a more rigorous preparation that might do to you what it does to everyone when you prepare for a relationship. It takes up the time of your life.
And who's having these conversations? Not enough people. Because another thing you said is we live in this, like, got to me, and I'm like, what is this? We live in a world that that can become enraged, not at injustice, but at survivors who won't stop speaking, people who are incensed because what they thought they could bury has now sprouted wings and flown beyond the fear that denied them agency and love. So where I went with that...
You took the whole quote from my speech.
Holy... you know how many times I had to push rewind? I had to push rewind a lot. But what that said to me is... I wasn't enraged, but I was sad because I did think things were better. Now I'm not incensed because it's so clear they're not. I mean, you know, in some ways there are a couple of things that are better, but not anywhere near the world that I want to live in. So you're right. People are like, don't bother me with that. I thought things were better, and why don't those people shut up? Because that's easier. But they're not ever going to shut up. Tell me that they're not ever going to shut up, because I'm not ever going to stop trying. I can tell you that. But it's like there's a whole cacophony of sound around our country and of course, the world that says, yeah, the tension's up. We are alive and we're not going back. Once I know, I can't not know.
Yeah.
Yeah, we need a 3-hour. We're going to can we start a podcast?
That quote really did stick with people, I find.
Oh my gosh.
I got a lot of feedback from that.
Yes.
And I think that the notion that of naming what's going on, which is people are upset that survivors can still speak. That was what we saw with Kavanaugh. Right? That's what we see oftentimes when we're talking about parading young black men before judges. That's what we're talking about when we talk about women in the workplace. And fundamentally, the challenge with that is, you know, privileged folks have an insistence on appreciation. They absolutely insist that you appreciate whatever you have.
There's another one. I'm so glad this is being recorded. Oh, my gosh. Yes. You're right.
And so if you're going to be an ally, you have to first realize that you can't insist on appreciation to be the product of your relationship. Right. So when you're talking about evaluating the world, you're saying, I thought the world was better. And if the world is better, as you were talking about, some of your African-American friends divulge things to you that are very specific to their specifically black lives. And in that divulgence, you are able to realize that things are not what you thought they were, that things may not be as progressive as you thought they were. But the reality is at some point you're going to have to let go of whatever grading rubric you have for evaluating the state of the world. The reality of the world is that it's full of rainbows and really awesome people and little babies and elderly people who really care and folks who are trying to make the world a different place and people who are going to work and working hard and being an inspiration. And it's also full of sex trafficking and, you know, pollutants. And we, you know, the EPA said we, you know, not the EPA, but the UN climate control said we got a strong 12 years before the Earth can't reverse course. We got all these issues, right? And until the human spirit, every individual human spirit, is able to align itself to mentally, emotionally, physically, physiologically, etc., hold those tensions and say it's not just what I want it to be, it's everything that it is, period, hard stop.
Wow.
You will continually be in a state of flux. And I mean that as a personal flux, professional flux, relational flux. You're constantly going to be in flux. That's why I'm saying, like, you know, I've got a stability that comes not just because I went to school and studied economics and I understand how markets work so I can talk about poverty and I can talk about to some of our corporate clients how their bottom line matters. Like, yeah, we can do all that. But the reality is the only reason you're resisting has nothing to do with spreadsheets, has nothing to do with your vocation. It has to do with the fact that your heart hurts when you think about this. Because your mind can't wrap itself around what you as an individual can do, you the grain of sand in this ocean of injustice, what are you going to do? You're going to do what a grain of sand can do. And until you let go of the weight of the ocean, you're always going to feel small. And you have to let that go. You know, The people who are insisting on appreciation are trying to own how someone else will feel. They're trying to then as well make themselves feel larger, which is just to say what they always thought they were. They're trying to make themselves feel like what they thought they were already. Right? Isn't this a great American country? Now, I'm an American, so I hope it is great, right? And if you say it's not, then that means it isn't, and then that means that I'm wrong. So in order for me to be right, you have to have not only not experienced that, not believe it happened, not be able to communicate about it, and then not be around me to say it if it is true. Right? Forget all that faking. Get rid of all of that. Get rid of all of that. Bring it down to brass tacks. We're people. Yeah. We are one human race. Exactly. We're killing each other. That's the reality of it. We're making space. We're taking space. We're loving each other sometimes. But the reality is, I think, and I'm making this bet, that the arc of justice, that the arc of time moves along justice. And that's an important thing. That's the hope. When we go back to the beginning of our conversation, right? And people say it's hopeless times. And, you know, they get upset because Donald Trump was elected president. And I'm like, all right, Donald Trump was elected president. And Barack Obama was also elected president. What do you think the Libyans thought about that? it matters whose team you're on.
It does, because I didn't care what the Libyans thought about that. You're right.
Yeah.
You're absolutely right.
And for me, I travel to Africa all the time. And so I am always hearing what the Africans think about American wars, about our philanthropy. I'm always, this goes back to Rotary, right? I'm always hearing about what people think about Western philanthropy as a form of relationship to formerly colonized countries. Because that's what it is. I'm always hearing that. Now, the question is, how does that affect me? And does that impede my ability to be effective? Right? Not being effective because I ignore it. Being effective because I understand, articulate, and incorporate it.
So, segue. It's perfect. It's like I probably should end the show because I have so much to think about. I'm probably going to get a migraine, but that's a good migraine. It'll be let me lay in bed and think about things that are really good and important to think about. But I, of course, believe that we are in urgent times on many levels.
Absolutely.
Many, many. And when the IPCC, the International Panel on Climate Change, comes out and says, basically, at the rate we're going, using metrics and science and, all of the things that should matter, fact-based research, that we have 12 years. So when I got into this, my background was in social services, and I worked with another catchy phrase, at-risk children and families. I've heard they've even changed that. So I am in this journey. I go to the rainforest. I come back and say, you know what? The sky really is falling. And if we want to hold it up, we've got to, preserve the rainforest, the rights of the indigenous people, blah, blah, blah. Well, then I'm into it a little bit and a little bit, a little bit. And I realize the people who are getting it the worst, hit the hardest, hit first, are who? The marginalized community, the poor, the black, the minorities, people, poor people. Where do they put the really crappy, railroads to transport all those toxic chemicals? I know. Where do they put the chicken factories that are disgusting and vile and stink and kill people? Yeah. I know.
This is what Standing Rock was about.
Oh, my God. So what's it going to take to touch the privileged before there are millions of people dying already. If you go to Africa, in sub-Saharan Africa, starvation is there, poverty is there. I could go on 3 hours about how the war in Syria, one of the root causes was climate change. And who wants to hear that? And when that was announced, I thought, what the heck is it going to take? 12 years, people. How old are you? It's good. We're going to start burning up. But then I said, there's people that are already starving, don't have access to clean water, dying from drought. And oh, by the way, it did not make the news tonight or last night or any other night. So what is it going to take?
I
want you to answer all my big questions now. Not fair, but I think you probably have it somewhere in there.
Yeah. No, I operate off of an abundance framework, and so I do believe that I have it. If I don't, then I know someone who does, and I'm thankful for having them. For this question, I have a bit. I don't have it all. I think that it starts with interruption. This is one of the reasons why I'm such a big fan of direct action campaigning. In my bio, you mentioned that I was one of the founding members of the Let Us Breathe Collective. That was an artist activist group that was started after Mike Brown was killed in Ferguson, Missouri, here in the U.S. And police from around the country mobilized at the support of the American citizenry to ensure that as we marched throughout those streets, we not only marched, but we were gassed and we were beaten and we were cordoned onto a one-block area that was called a marching zone. And we started, I'm saying that because I was there at Ferguson. That was an interruption point in my life where I had come from being the darling of the hood, so to speak. I was the black man who everybody was like, this is what we need more of in the world.
Right, right.
Right. We need African-American men to step up and take responsibility for their communities. And we need them to understand the importance of education and give back and mentor and all of you. And that's great.
He made it. Look, he made it.
Yeah.
That's one of my favorites.
I mean, privilege maintains itself by fundamentally insisting on exceptions being the standard. And that's why I've learned to shake off the chains of being the only, the lonely only, and always reminding people to never, ever, ever try to crown me. Never, ever, ever try to make me an exception, because I know what that feels like to be the person who really does want it, and everyone says you don't want it, but you don't have access to get it, and they just keep sending you these well-groomed, polished, successful people that have your identity but don't have your life anymore, to say you can do it too, without structurally changing the environment. They're not actually changing the environment. They're just saying, like, have hope. Someone survived. We won't actually change the environment you're living in, and we won't even name the things that are happening. We'll just keep, asking people to just give back. And without investigating how they may be taking first. And if you grow up and talk about it, then we'll say that you're being difficult or otherwise. But to the point that I was trying to make around, you're getting off on these tangents.
No, but I like it. And I'm following you. So that's even scarier. It's like, yeah, but this is important conversation, really important, because I have a voice and it'll help me think about what I want that voice to sound like. And that matters a lot to me. So keep going on the tangents.
You've got to. What I was trying to say is that interruption is absolutely necessary for people who are living in comfort. I wish it was. I say necessary rather than desirable. It's necessary because comfort rarely destabilizes itself enough to see the world. We are always all trying to keep the veneer of comfort up. America right now is financially overextended, right? Like. even the white Chicagoans in my city, 36% of them are currently housing burdened, right? Like they don't have enough money to live in the city, and they make the most money.
Yeah. Yep.
Right.
So, yep. Yes.
You know what I mean? Like people are faking it out here.
Yeah.
And so interruption often comes through revelation or tribulation. We would hope that revelation, because that's more graceful. But sometimes it comes through tribulation, and that's more unfortunate, but sometimes also sends that message, though I would want for it not to be as such. So the reason why I mentioned direct action campaigning and Ferguson and Let Us Breathe is because that was when I learned that it's not enough to just give philanthropically. It's not enough to mentor. You have to engage the system that creates that environment. And that's where I started working with my friends, and we're laying our bodies down on Michigan Avenue, and we're shutting down major institutions on the Magnificent Mile, and we're challenging the mayor of the city in his office. We're writing letters to our president, who looks like us. We're organizing for policy platforms that actually speak to the divestment of our communities to fund police as a community development strategy for our communities, and saying that that's not how you develop black communities, by sending in more guns. It's by opening up the mental health clinics, and it's by fully funding education. It's by understanding a continuum of coordinated care. It's of understanding what a child brings when they come to work, and that it's not just a book bag, it's everything from home, and preparing the teachers to engage that. It's all of those types of things. And that direct interruption of what I mean, I'll be specific, of shutting down entire highways. That's what we were doing. We were shutting down entire thoroughfares. We were shutting down restaurants, and people were trying to eat brunch. We were interrupting people for 20, 30 minutes of their day, saying, listen, we are here, we are counted, and we are unheard. We don't want to spend our days like this. I don't want to lay my body down on a four-lane highway. And if anybody thinks someone does, you are
nuts.
So far off base.
Yeah, really nuts.
No one wants to do this.
Yeah, yeah.
But the reality is the alternative is we go back home to where we came from, or like me, you're rising up in the ranks of the world and watching your family die off. You're watching them be affected by the systemic injustice, and so you have to go back for them. You know, and so interruption, when you talk about hunger, climate issues, these types of things, revelation is what the studies are for, right? Read this study produced by the Aspen Institute or whomever. It's about climate change. Take the advice and make some changes. Same thing a dietitian would say, right? Right? Like,
yeah,
hey, you
yeah.
know, you're a little off base, your cholesterol's high. What you need to do is eat these types of foods and then exercise three times a week, right? You can take that and that revelation, or you can end up with triple bypass surgery. Or the earth itself can be unsuitable for human life.
Right.
Or you can watch as half a city is plagued by poverty and the majority of them look like people of color. Right? The tribulation side of it. And you can sit and try to think, how effective is my philanthropy going to be for this? Right?
Yeah, there are some things like, you just can't write a check to change. I mean, it's true.
You just can't.
You just
and,
can't.
And I keep going back to philanthropy because economics is the primary transactional relationship I find as a form of racial reconciliation that most people are willing to engage in.
And that
they don't actually know folks, right? Who
right,
are black.
Right.
They do give to people
right,
who are black.
For their
or
cause.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that conversation, I was at a national conference in October of last year, Bioneers, which is a play on the word pioneers, you know, for the earth. And a lot of the young people, especially from, you know, the Latinos, as they were saying, Latinas and the indigenous people, they were going with this. We have billions of dollars in foundations and we're spending the interest.
Yeah.
It's time to open the coffers and bring about real change. And it's annoying as heck. At colleges, universities, there's all this student debt and they're sitting on billions of dollars in investments. And how does that work? I mean, I don't know if we'll ever pay off my youngest daughter's student loan, and it's a burden. And
I'm still paying my student loan.
Oh, yeah. I mean, you just kind of live with it. You know what I mean? It's like we did it and she's helping and all that.
Be like the cancer. I feel like it shouldn't be like a cancer. My education shouldn't feel like cancer.
I know that you're never going to get rid of. I agree. I totally agree. And hindsight is
a hard process to do it.
Yeah, no kidding. And we wanted, you know, it's another one of those things. So we are at an hour. And the only thing I can ask of you is to consider in about 6 months, I'd love you to come back because I have a whole bunch of other questions. Because our world needs these kind of conversations, and I'm willing to be open and vulnerable and look at myself. And there's just one quick little story I want to tell you about 10 years ago, and you may have reignited that in me, which is good, because our tagline now, our hashtag is Disruptors for Good. We believe there has to be lots of disruptions. So I was working within Rotary, and we were doing this, we called it Building the Future. That was the tagline that year, Building the Future with Action and Vision. And some of us wanted to start a mentor program. Excuse me. And we did. And it has been successful beyond our wildest dreams, because many of us are still involved in those kids' lives. And I'm not crying. I just have something in my throat. Excuse me. But I did this ladder speech, and your speech encouraged me to maybe step up and do another TED Talk and talk about it, because what I did was a lot of research on who's in jail and risk factors, because I was running a mental health, a social service agency, and I made everybody in the club, you know, Rotary is a lot of white men, a lot of rich white men.
Yeah.
And I'd say, okay, everybody get a piece of paper. And I made them do it because, you know, they're like, who is this chick? And I'm not going to do what she says. So I'd walk around to the table and say, no, you have to get your piece of paper out. Everybody has a paper and pencil, and we're going to draw ladders. And I based it on research, and I said, if you were born white, step up one step on the ladder. you know, and then I did the whole thing based on criminal justice information. If your parents were married, step up on the ladder. If one of your parents read, step up on the ladder. And I led them through a series of seven questions. 95% of the people in the room were on ladder seven. And I said, so when you say, I made it, why can't they? You made it. Shame on you if you didn't. And I made them cry. I made men cry because I said, we just think, oh, yeah, I made it. I worked so hard. Nobody ever gave me anything. You were born with seven tools in your toolbox, and all you had to do was come out of the chute. And it's like, I literally had people come up to me and say, I never thought about it that way. I never thought about how much I had just by showing up. Even if they were poor, they still had all these things. So maybe I'll be that inspiration to touch more Rotarians, which I believe is inherently good. But when was the last woman international RI president? Oh, that's right. We never had one. So it's like Rotary has some work to do too. But I hope, hopefully we'll be part of that change. So the last thing I'd like you to do is just kind of give us something. One call to action. Is it to be that disruptor? Is it to be that agitator? What, for people that are listening and that care, is there one call to action that you would encourage us to take?
Of course. You know, I do this audit sometimes to see whether people understand what it means to really help. And there's a framework that I use. Many people use the term ally. You've probably heard that term, being an ally to someone.
Right.
there's allies, they're advocates, and they're accomplices. And the thing that I would ask everyone to do is to figure out which one you want to be, and then make sure you're being all of them at some point. Because the reality is that we do need all of them to be there. And the way that I think about it is, an ally is someone who supports or they amplify what marginalized persons do, where and how they do it. So that can be like marching with someone. That
right.
can be like
right.
Voting, how they vote. That can be going to a panel where they're speaking. That can be supporting a small business that's run by a woman, supporting a small business that's run by a person of color or by an LGBTQIA person. The other side of that is an advocate, and this is going up the risk scale. Right, advocates support and amplify what marginalized persons do where they cannot do it and in ways that would put them at risk. So you're not at risk. So this may be something where someone, for instance, I'm a male, and I've done this before where people, you know, women or LGBTQ folks, they have problems in the workplace, but I'm a guy.
Right.
And HR doesn't hear it from me the same
right,
way.
Right, right.
And so they're having an issue. Like, I brought, you know, what some people call sticky issues before senior management in organizations I worked at, on their behalf. Just to, you know, we're just asking, have we ever done an audit about gender parity as it relates to compensation here? I'm just wondering, HR team, you know, just wondering.
Just saying.
Just little old Xavier.
Yeah.
you know, what's our policy on whether a person could wear a hijab here or not? Is that a thing? Do we have anything in the employee manual? I didn't say anything. I'm a Christian, just saying.
Yeah.
Right? Now I'm advocating.
Right.
It's a risk for them, it's not a risk for me. But
right.
they still need it to be done. And then the final one is accomplicing. That's supporting or amplifying what marginalized persons do where they cannot, but also in ways that put you at risk. This is what we can't seem to get enough people to do, which is surrender their privilege.
Yeah.
The level of the person you said you wanted to relate to.
Yeah.
You have to surrender that privilege and take on that risk. One of the things I talked about in that speech, if you recall, I said, I'm holding the tension of my own reality. At the end of my speech, I said, hey, look, I'm a privileged American, right? I'm a man on this earth.
Right.
We're running it, right? I have all these privileges. I'm also black, but I also grew up the way I grew up.
Right.
I also have all the traumas I have. Now, that's all intersectional, and I need to hold that tension with joy, but that doesn't mean that I'm off the hook. Because my work starts where my privilege starts. And so when I think about how I can be an ally, an advocate, or an accomplice, I always think about those risks, those levels of risk, and am I actually taking it? So when you think about this, and this is for anyone who's listening, think about that last part around being an accomplice. How are you actually supporting and amplifying what marginalized people are saying or doing where they cannot, but in ways that also put you at risk? And this is going back into your home and saying at the dinner table, hey, y'all, we need to talk about Black Lives Matter. Hey, y'all, we need to talk about whether we, you know, we think it's wrong that people are saying they shouldn't be have to sell to people who are LGBTQ. Right. We need to actually engage this. Or, hey, I'm going to go talk to my boss about this issue around gender parity. And I know I'm up for a promotion, but this needs to be done now.
Yeah. What a way to start the new year for Mrs. Green's world and our listeners and this show and for me to help shape it and the kind of shows we do. So I could not appreciate it more. It's a very propitious time. And there are days when I wish I wasn't alive, but there are many more days when I'm so glad I am because I'm finding more of my voice. And thank you. Thank you so very sincerely. And I just have to forward promote. We have on January 10th, we're going to be talking about energy smart homes on our local show with Tucson Electric Power. Gabe Esquibe is going to be with us. And then for our national show, Marcy Zaroff, Eco Renaissance, Live It, Share It, Work It, Be It. And she is one of the first people that started to uncover all of the wrong and filth and oppression in the fashion industry, and she's doing something about it. So I can't wait to have her back. So Xavier, thank you for showing up in my life and giving me a headache and all the things that I'm going to have to talk about now.
The overwhelmed.
That's right. I'm a white woman overwhelmed. So there's a lot of alliteration there, but I appreciate it. And it was just there really aren't enough words. So thanks for showing up in my world and for showing up for everybody in Mrs. Green's world.
Prepare. That's all I'll say.
Prepare.
Don't just care. Prepare.
We'll leave it at that. Thanks, everybody.